There's a culture war going on in this country. We can no longer remain silent on the issues that affect us all. Decisions we make now will determine our future. But how do we engage with the culture in a way that honors Jesus? How do we rise above the noise to know what is right and what is true? It's time to bring God back into the conversation. It's time to reconnect. Here's Carmen.
Welcome, friends. I'm Carmen LaBurge, and this is The Reconnect, where we're putting God in His place, back where He belongs, right in the middle of every conversation. So how do we do that? How do we enter into the conversations of the day as the ambassadors of Jesus Christ? How do we speak the mind of Christ on the matters of the day? Let's face it, people don't need just another piece of our mind. I mean, you've been in those conversations. Let me give you a piece of my mind. And you're thinking to yourself, I don't really need a piece of your mind. I really could use, however, the piece of the mind of Christ. So how do we give that to people? How do you actually share with another person the peace which passes all understanding? How do you invite them into a conversation where Jesus, who is the Prince of Peace, is actually party to the conversation? So that's our role. That's our responsibility as the ambassadors of Jesus Christ, ambassadors of the kingdom of heaven in the midst of the conversations taking place in the kingdoms of this world. If you'd like some equipping on that, we have resources posted for you online at reconnectwithcarmen.com. While you're there, we invite you to sign up for our email newsletter. You'll get lots of information and commentary that we just don't have time to share here in this hour on the air. So you can like The Reconnect on Facebook. You can let us know what you're thinking about on Twitter. I am available there at Carmen LaBurge. All right, so the website is reconnectwithcarmen.com and on Twitter at Carmen LaBurge. Here we go. So in a week where the President of the United States has been advocating for peace, we have witnessed ISIS-affiliated suicide bombing in Manchester, UK, taking the lives of 22 people, predominantly young people. We have seen religiously motivated terrorists involved in the shooting and killing of at least 26 Coptic Christians on a bus just south of Cairo, Egypt. We are watching the unfolding siege of a city in the Philippines by ISIL-associated individuals from outside of that country. So in the face of all of that, we're trying to have these conversations about peace. We're trying to have conversations about how to live at peace with one another, how to bring peace, how to restore peace, how to, be people of peace. And even here in this country, when we're having those conversations, we look to Montana, where we have a newly elected congressman who certainly did not demonstrate his ability to maintain a peace in his own being in a conflict with a reporter earlier this week. So in terms of our own conversations with each other about peace, I do want to bring it home, and then I want to have a global conversation. So bringing it home, let me just set this challenge before each and every one of us. If we are not people who are restored to a relationship of peace with God through Jesus Christ, then we're not at peace with ourselves. We're not at peace with our neighbor. We're not at peace with the people in our homes. And so what hope do we have of being peacemakers in the wider world? That's really where I think this conversation, you know, ends up for each and every one of us. This is about being a person who is at peace in the midst of whatever circumstances we find ourselves in. And so that's going to be the conversation that I'm going to keep returning us to in the midst of this larger conversation about the desire for global peace. So the desire for global peace, which has certainly been at the center of the president's messaging all around the world during what I will describe as his world religion tour. He's now having conversations with our NATO allies. But earlier, you know, he's been having conversations with the leaders of Muslim-majority nations, the leaders of Israel, Palestinian leaders, certainly the Pope, and on and on and on. So the conversation has been about peace. And ultimately, we all recognize that this is a battle for hearts and minds. That's actually the language that that is used in describing this war on terror. So it's a war on terror, and the battlefield is the heart and minds of people. And you say to yourself, well, that's a theological battle. That's an existential battle. And so how are we going to actually engage in a battle for hearts and minds with people who are set on waging actual physical war against our bodies, against the existence of their neighbors. So I think that that's the, you know, we're trying to have this conversation on multiple fronts or on multiple planes. And you cannot assume that when you meet another person, they are like a tabula rasa. There's nothing there yet. You're just simply going to be able to communicate truth to them and imprint it upon them as if they are a blank slate. That's just not how people come. That's just not how people come to us. They arrive in conversation with us. They arrive in encounters with us. They arrive on our shores full of affections and commitments and dreams and beliefs and experiences and a sense of what is true. And it is ideas that are driving action. It's ideas driving your actions today. And it is ideas driving the actions of others. And some people have ideas that produce actions that are contrary to living in community with people of diverse ideas. That's the bottom line. So when we talk about the need for, let's say, real integration, our Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson, uses the phrase full assimilation. So we talk about real integration of people into, you know, from diverse backgrounds, but into a community together, from diverse backgrounds, fully assimilated into existing systems, existing cultures. We're talking about a transformation of the way people see and experience and engage with the world. That is no small undertaking. You're not just asking people to change their address. You're asking people to change their worldview, to change the way they engage with the reality of the world. And so when we talk about a battle for hearts and minds, that's what we're talking about. How much would it take for you to give up your view of the world and adopt a different view of the world in order to integrate or assimilate into another culture? Just ask yourself that question for a moment, because my guess is most of us would dig our heels right in and say, there's nothing, there's absolutely nothing that could make me abandon my worldview. Because my worldview is the truth, capital T, Jesus, the way and the truth and the life. I'm reconciled to God the Father through him. My life is animated by his spirit. This is life. This isn't just what I'm doing. This is reality. Okay, so if you and I are reticent to abandon our worldview in order to adopt the worldview of someone else, can you not imagine for a moment the reticence on the part of another whose worldview is quite different than ours, in fact, oppositional to ours? Convincing them to abandon their worldview and adopt our worldview, which is the concept of assimilation or integration, is just frankly unlikely to happen in a lot of cases. So I don't think we're ultimately talking about full integration or full assimilation. I think we're talking about figuring out how to live peaceably with one another. And I would say that when we say peaceably, I'm using that term in its broadest definition, which would simply be not having open, active conflict with one another. So of conflict avoidance might be my most gross definition of what it would mean to live peaceably with one another. Because to actually share in peace, in a peaceable relationship with another person, to be at peace with another person, means that my spirit and their spirit get along. And my spirit can only get along with the spirit of Christ living in another person. So to live at peace with another Christian is not difficult, because we both possess the peace that passes all understanding. To live at genuine peace with anyone who does not possess and is possessed by the spirit of the living God, I got to tell you, there is enmity there. There is conflict there. If you are at enmity with the God whom I know and worship and love and adore, and whose kingdom I'm seeking to advance in the midst of the kingdoms of this world, if you are at enmity with God, then you're going to be at enmity with me. It's just that simple. So I can share the hope that we could live in conflict avoidance, that we could live in some sort of negotiated, I'm not going to hurt you, you're not going to hurt me. But this concept that we're going to actually create some kind of negotiated, superficial peace with people whose ideologies are oppositional at an existential level is just unrealistic. I know, that's probably doesn't sound very hopeful. Because then just as soon as I say that, then I should say, hey, I am also a person who expects always the unexpected and anticipates miracles, knowing that with God, all things are actually possible. So if God decides that suddenly the world is going to be awash with peace, then he's certainly in a position to make that happen. That'd be great. I would love that. That would be a stunning development in what's going on right now. I would argue that peace is not possible without God. Better said, real peace is not possible without a genuinely restored relationship, a relationship of peace with the real God. So that means I believe that the gospel is the answer to the question that the world is asking about peace. So the fact that there is now this global desire for peace, fomented by some absolutely terrifying people, which is why it's called terrorism. We are literally scared enough to the point to want peace. Now, just think about that for a moment. We are being pushed as a very, very diverse global community. We are being pushed to want peace with one another, conflict avoidance at least, because of a common threat, because of a common enemy. And that existential threat is being posed in the Middle East and potentially globally by one country, and that's Iran. So if you just want to, reduce this down to, to let us all pick one enemy, and the enemy of my enemy is my friend, like, that's how we're going to get there in some of these foreign policy conversations. But the desire, this newly awakened desire for peace globally, is leading people to have conversations about good and evil, about theological realities, about basic morality. Is forcing secular people to have very uncomfortable conversations. Because you can't define concept of good and evil from a secular worldview. It's just, you cannot describe wickedness from a secular worldview. Like, you can't describe sin. You can't get to the root cause of what's going on unless you have a theological framework out of which to work. So what I'm saying is, all of this provides an incredible opportunity for you and I as believers, an incredible opportunity to actually become people not only possessed of peace, but who actually have the opportunity to introduce other people to the one who can give them peace of mind, a peace with God, and out of that, a peace with other people. And the faith that empowers us to live at peace, even in a world of constant war. I think that is the great opportunity set before us as Christians in the middle of this conversation about peace. So the desire for peace, I would say, is an opportunity for you and I to live into our calling as ambassadors of the one who is indeed the Prince of Peace. So if you want some scripture passages to focus your energy and attention on in terms of this conversation, the prayers for peace that are articulated in the Old Testament, particularly in the sixth chapter of Numbers, right? So there's this prayer for peace in Numbers 6, verses 22 to 27, that's really echoed on several occasions in the New Testament. And you could look at 1 Thessalonians 5:23 and Hebrews 13:20 and 21. And we talk about the responsibility that we have to pray for the peace of Jerusalem, right? That is one of the prayers, that is one of the commands of Scripture, that you and I are to pray for the peace of Jerusalem. And I think that there are times that we don't quite know how to pray for the peace of Jerusalem. It is like this is like an open wound in terms of world religions and a conflict zone. But we're mandated in Scripture to pray for the peace of Jerusalem. And so I'm going to invite you into that. I'm going to invite you into praying shalom for Jerusalem, recognizing that the Jewish concept of shalom is about wholeness and completeness. It is about a comprehensive peace. It's not just about the kind of superficial peace that we might be tempted to describe as just non-conflict. The Hebrew word shalom is really a fully orbed view of what it means to live in such a way that promotes the human flourishing of everyone. So if we could actually live at shalom, in shalom with one another, that would be great. So when you pray for the peace of Jerusalem, just pray shalom. I mean, it's God's word. It's a Hebrew word. He knows it. He's familiar with it. He knows what he means when he says it. And so I just pray shalom for Jerusalem today and encourage you to do likewise. Also, want to continue lifting up prayers for our Coptic brothers and sisters in Egypt. The Coptic Christians continue to be intensely persecuted, and we don't want to ever have these events become so common that we fail to weep with those who weep and genuinely acknowledge the gravity of the situation, where people cannot even, as Christians, load a bus and count on getting safely from one place to another without the threat of everyone on the bus being shot and killed, and our on social media actually watching their blood soak into the desert sands. So I think we should never grow weary of praying. I think we should never grow weary of working for persecuted Christians, on behalf of persecuted Christians around the world. And so certainly praying with and for our Coptic brothers and sisters here in the United States and around the world as they grieve the death of these new martyrs. May the blood of these martyrs cry out with the blood of the martyrs whose names, you know, some of whose names we know, but whose images we certainly know. You will remember it was Coptic Christians in orange jumpsuits kneeling on a Libyan beach. You will remember these images when I bring them to mind. You will remember the bombing of the Coptic churches, taking the lives of women and children just prior to Christmas. So just be aware of these things that are happening to our brothers and sisters around the world, and keep them in your ardent prayers. All right, when we talk about existential pain, there was a study released this week that frankly did not rise to the level of attention for most of the mainstream media. And why is that? Well, because the report does not actually tell the narrative that they, I think, want to be telling in terms of advocacy for physician-assisted suicide here in the United States. So those who want to be advocating for access to assisted suicide, which, you know, the reason that we're talking about this is a life issue. This is a primary issue for Christians to be on the forefront of the conversation in our culture. And so this is an opportunity to be equipped, not just on the subject of, hey, the reborn are going to advocate for the preborn. That's absolutely something we should be doing. But those of us who know Christ and live in Christ also need to be advocates of life at every stage, from conception to natural death. And so how do I be an advocate for life at the end of life? And well, part of that is being up to speed on these conversations related to legislation that is sweeping the country in these so-called dying with dignity or death with dignity pieces of legislation. So we want to highlight that the Maine legislature, the legislature in the state of Maine, has actually rejected an assisted suicide bill in that state that would have allowed physicians to prescribe lethal doses of medication to patients who asked for it, and then the patients would self-administer that medication at the time of their choosing. So we want to celebrate that in that action by the state legislature in the state of Maine. However, we want to also recognize that the vote was actually pretty close, and the debate was really long. And the substantive part of the debate from the side of those advocating for physician-assisted suicide, for access to lethal doses of medication by patients, was all about autonomy. It was all about choice. It was all about maintaining control, listen to those words, until the very end, actually controlling your own death and when you die. So most of the testimony, this holds true pretty much across the United States in advocacy for this kind of legislation, most of the testimony is very personal. It's very hard to listen to because it's all about pain and suffering. And none of us want to be participating in bringing about or lengthening the pain and suffering of other people, right? We want to be people who alleviate those things, not people who prolong it. Well, this report issued in the New England Journal of Medicine. So it's not like a slouch report out there, right? This is like this is like real science by real scientists, and it's reported in the New England Journal of Medicine. And the article is entitled, the article covering it that I pulled is from the Washington Post, and it's entitled, "It's Not Pain, But Existential Distress That Leads People to Assisted Suicide." So the article observes that what I just made an observation about, that most people who are advocating for physician-assisted suicide advocate for it on the basis of pain. Well, what this study actually found, the study was released on Wednesday in the New England Journal of Medicine. What they found was the reasons patients gave for wanting to end their lives had more to do with psychological suffering than physical pain. So reading a couple of paragraphs from this article. "For many people, death from a terminal illness may be synonymous with pain. Much of the discussion about assisted suicide focuses on compassionate palliative care for patients, suffering that cannot be controlled by even the strongest drugs. But that's not what the people in the new study report." So here's the quote. "It's what I call existential distress," explained researcher Madeline Lee, an associate professor at the University of Toronto. Quote, "Their quality of life is not what they want. They are mostly educated and affluent, people who are used to being successful and in control of their lives, and that's how they want their death to be." The author of the article, Adriana Cha, she observes this. "One of the main things these patients bring up has to do with autonomy. It's a broad philosophical concept," she says, "that has to do with being able to make our own decisions, not being dependent on others, wanting to be able to enjoy the things you enjoy, and wanting dignity." Well, I would argue that autonomy is a much bigger issue than even this article suggests. But autonomy and the delusion of it, maybe more aptly, that is just actually what the world is selling to people, that those of us who know God know is not reality. We are not autonomous. We were not designed to be autonomous. We were designed to be human beings, image bearers of the living God, in a continuing relationship of dependence upon Him, and in a continual effort in this life and into eternity to glorify Him. That's not autonomy. That's the absolute connection and connectivity of my life to the life of the one who created me and in Christ redeemed me and by the power of the Holy Spirit animates my life. This isn't just about a life here on earth. This is about the reality of life forevermore. So if my identity is somehow so connected to only this physical experience, then I am led to imagine that I have control. I have control over my life. Well, the loss of control is something that everybody experiences at some point in the course of a lifetime. At some point, the choice that someone else makes is going to negatively impact you, or you're going to get a diagnosis that is not by your choice. Something is going to befall you that was not by your choice. And so that's when we come to terms, to grips with the fact that we are not autonomous beings. We do not have an identity that is just completely unto ourselves and made by our own choosing. But when you think about this issue of autonomy, and you think about the conversations that are happening in our culture related not only to end-of-life issues, but to the issues related to abortion, and issues related to sexual identity, or issues related to racial identity, okay, the concept of being transgender, or the concept of being transracial, or the concept of being anything other than what you actually are, the identity crisis that we are experiencing in our culture runs deep. And so no surprise that the identity crisis has now extended into the conversation about end-of-life issues. So, you and I as Christians need to recognize that one of the major conflicts in our culture is the illusion of autonomy. And we were never designed to be autonomous, but people of God inhabiting the world that He so loves. All right, friends, this is The Reconnect. Visit me online at reconnectwithcarmen.com. While you're at the website, become a reconnector. We need some ministry support, and you're the one who can give it. Thanks a lot.
Started something good.
Hey friends, I'm Carmen LaBurge, and this is The Reconnect, and indeed, God has started something good inside each and every one of us, and that good thing he intends to bring to completion on the day of Jesus Christ. So God's actually working right now inside you, inside your heart, and inside your mind, inside your spirit, seeking to bring each and every one of us by one degree of glory to another into conformity with his Son, Jesus Christ. And he's not going to give up till he's done. So there you go. Each one of us is a work in progress today. Let's find time today to celebrate the progress that God is making by our cooperation with his spirit within us. We're seeking here on The Reconnect to put God in his place back where he belongs, right in the middle of every conversation. So we would invite you to connect with us online at reconnectwithcarmen.com. You can like us on Facebook. You can always let me know what you're thinking about on Twitter. I'm at Carmen LaBurge. All right, so we were talking before the break about this idea that We are, you know, we live as if this is a false, this is a false idea, but we live as if we're autonomous. And then we come to find out, in fact, we're not in control of so many things. And so one of the things we're not in control of is the weather. And so those of you who have big plans this Memorial Day weekend and happen to live in the part of the country that I live in, my plans to be outside doing things are not, it's not inside my control whether or not the weather is going to cooperate with all of that. And I just heard this morning that, you know, those people who predict how many hurricanes we're going to get in a hurricane season, which starts on June the 1st, they think there's going to be 17 named storms, and they're predicting that four or five are going to be, you know, the really bad kind. Friends, we're not in control of that. And so there are evidences all around us every day that we're not ultimately in control. And so I want to have a conversation today with Jamie Ayton. Now, Jamie Ayton has been on the program with us before in his capacity as the founder and co-director of the Humanitarian Disaster Institute, that's HDI, at Wheaton College. He co-authored a book called The Disaster Ministry Handbook, that helps churches prepare for disaster, provide relief to survivors, care for the vulnerable, and help their communities recover. But what I'm really here to talk with Jamie about today, or he's here to talk with us about today, is a personal kind of disaster and the moment in time when you find out at a personal level that you're not in control. So, Jamie, welcome back to the Reconnect.
Thanks so much for having me, Carmen.
And maybe we'll just start right there by allowing you to sort of tell your own personal disaster story.
Sure. You know, the way I actually got into all this work was and became a disaster psychologist was my family and I had moved down to South Mississippi just 6 days before Hurricane Katrina hit and have been studying disasters ever since. And then about 8 years later, I started having some back pain and then started having some leg pain. And this is at the age of 35. And so I thought, oh, well, maybe I, you know, just got injured and went to the doctors on and off for about a year. Couldn't quite figure it out. And then ended up having some pretty significant symptoms. And my doctor said, okay, we need to do some serious tests right now. And we're going to have to put you under to do an exam. And right before he put me under, I was told that the chances of this being anything other than, you know, just kind of a normal health issue and the chances of it being cancer was less than 1%. Next thing I know, I wake up and I overhear the doctor telling my wife that it is indeed cancer, and actually found that not only did I have cancer at age 35, but it had actually spread and I was diagnosed with stage 4 colon cancer.
Mm. Tell us about that. I mean, tell us about that moment, because 35, first of all, is really young. And this is not something that we prepare ourselves for. So share with us, I mean, you're a Christian. And so where were you at in terms of faith response? Where were you at in terms of just gut level response? Where were you at in terms of the response with your wife? Just kind of give us a window into not only that moment, but maybe those hours.
Sure. You know, I was really in shock that as I was hearing, you know, the news and then later had to go back to see an oncologist to actually get everything confirmed. And when the oncologist shared, you know, the extent to the, how bad it was, it just seemed like it was unreal. You know, it didn't seem like it was actually happening. And as the news finally started kind of sinking in, you know, I started to choke up, and the doctor had trying to kind of keep me together and help me cope, you know, ask some basic questions of, so Jamie, what is it you do for a living? And I shared with him that I'm a disaster researcher and I direct the Humanitarian Disaster Institute. And he kind of pauses for a moment and he says to me that, well, you're in for your own personal disaster. And in that moment, it was quite frightening, just the reality of realizing that, you know, when Hurricane Katrina was threatening our family, we were able to evacuate. But in that moment, I realized there was going to be no evacuation. And it was just incredibly humbling, realizing how little control I actually had in that moment.
Hmm. So knowing what you knew at that point in time about the process at a psychological level and in terms of faith, the process that an individual and or a family goes through when there's a disaster from the outside, so a hurricane, what were the parallels, and then maybe what were some of the things that are different when you're talking about a personal level disaster?
Yeah, you know, I think some of the ways that it was similar was that I found, for instance, when you find out this really difficult news. Like when you go through a disaster, it used to be that mental health professionals used to do an intervention where they would try to get the person, sometimes even in large groups, to disclose all the trauma and all the feelings that they were going through immediately after the disaster event. And what we now know is that having somebody do that after a major disaster is actually harmful in most cases, that it's kind of like going to a doctor, asking them to open up a wound, knowing that they don't have a bandage to put back over it. So what we actually do now when we intervene in a major disaster is my job is not to go in and do talk therapy, but really just to help that person cope and to stabilize them and help them keep themselves together to weather the storm. And what I found when I was diagnosed with cancer was the same thing, that in those early stages, and in fact, the one difference was when Hurricane Katrina hit, it would often go over a community and pass from the beginning and go on through within about 30 minutes, right? But when you have a personal disaster, in my case, like cancer, it was like having Hurricane Katrina set on top of me for a full year. So one of the big differences was that after Katrina, as soon as the storm passes, you're automatically a survivor. When you go through some personal disasters like cancer, you may be in survival mode for up to a year or maybe even a lifetime that you're kind of constantly fighting. And so it's pretty common, I learned then from my own experience, that sometimes you kind of like a tree that's growing, that you sometimes have to shed some of what you don't need to be able to get more rooted and continue to grow.
So let's talk about, and let me just remind my listeners, I'm talking to Dr. Jamie Ayton. You can follow him on Twitter at Dr. Jamie Ayton. You can also find some resources about what we're talking about in terms of disaster ministry for your church to engage in, for you to prepare for as a Christian who wants to be mobilized in conversations with your neighbors about these things and come alongside and help people cope. You can find those resources at wheaton.edu/HDI, which stands for Humanitarian Disaster Institute. So, Jamie, I have so many questions, but so I think that the way that I want to go from here is just to discover what we want to be helpful. We don't want to be hurtful. We don't want to ask invasive questions, but we need some information to find out how to help. So we offer things like, hey, I'll do anything. Just let me know what you need. And yet I think oftentimes people who are devastated, they're, you know, the storm is, they don't know what they need. So help us understand how to be helpful. And let's just talk very specifically. Like, let's just say I know somebody who just got a cancer diagnosis, or someone in their immediate family just got a cancer diagnosis. What should I do?
You know, when it comes to those situations, I just really want to encourage everyone to remember that you don't have to be perfect when you help. You just have to be present. That when we find out somebody's going through something with being really difficult, we oftentimes, and I even find myself still struggling with this now, when reaching out to people, worrying about what am I going to say, and sometimes that actually freezes me up and makes it hard to reach out to help others. And I just want to encourage you, don't worry so much about what you say, but instead go be with that person. Think about how can you walk alongside them. And it's really important to ask them, you know, what is it that you need? And be mindful that the person that you're trying to help may not know, and in that moment may actually not need the help right at that time. So do really listen and respect what that person's wishes are, but also don't be afraid to go back and ask them. So I know last week you said you were okay, you had meals taken care of. So I want to check in on this week. Is there anything that I could do? Maybe help with the kids, help with the lawn. And really respect what that person is asking for. And so also be mindful that if you're telling them that you want to help, make sure that you actually follow up on that and help in the ways that they're asking for assistance.
Okay, that's so Jesus-y, right?
Right.
I mean, no, Jesus, you know, he not only are you talking about a ministry that's incarnational, right? Like show up and be present. Let your presence be the gift in most cases. And then listen, I so appreciate when Jesus actually asks people, what do you want me to do for you? Like, he already knows, right? He's God. He knows what's in that person's heart. And yet he dignifies them by saying, you know, what do you want me to do for you? What are you looking for? And so I think that when you tell us, when you remind us that we need to listen and we need to respect what folks are articulating, what they're viewing as their own needs, and having us not anticipate what we imagine their needs are. That's just so helpful. Can we talk about the identity question? I know some parents who have children who are cancer survivors, and they are struggling with helping their child, you know, now at the point where, you know, you've survived, you are a cancer survivor, but actually then just starting to live again as a normal kid, because they're still living at some level with this identity as a person who, you know, for them struggled at a formative stage of life being a person who had cancer. So can you talk about the identity part of this?
Sure. And, you know, I think you're already kind of queuing up a really important point there, is that there's a difference between surviving and survivorship, right? The surviving is that you're doing everything you can just to make it, you know, for the storm to pass. But survivorship really can take almost an entire person's lifetime to really kind of make sense and reconcile that experience that you've had, especially if it's a life-threatening trauma. So especially for kids, I'll give an example from Hurricane Katrina and then bring it back to cancer, that there was an instance, it was about a year, 2 years after Hurricane Katrina, and I was at this community meeting with mental health professionals and school teachers and other church leaders, and they were all talking about the kids having all these acting out behaviors, like kind of out of nowhere. And they were all really worried about the kids, and they were wanting to diagnose them with all these different mental health issues. And so I asked them, well, tell me what you're actually witnessing. Let's not label, just give me what you're observing. So I start writing down the symptoms, and suddenly everybody in the room at once whispered, oh my goodness, it's trauma. And it's very common for kids, especially when they're going through something very terrible at a young age, that they can't quite get their heads around it. And you may not actually see acting out or changes in behaviors or struggles when they're first going through it. It may not start to surface until they start to have then the intellectual capacity to really make sense of what they went through. And as that starts, they start to grow developmentally, they start to raise questions, and then sometimes you start to see in some ways almost a reliving of that trauma. And in fact, I've even gone through that as an adult, that in many ways after I went through my cancer experience, I kind of just jumped back into life as best as I could to get back to normal, and then ended up being hospitalized for almost a month, and it really caught me off guard and kind of brought all that trauma back to the surface. And as I started to finally sort through what had happened, it was kind of like I was not only living in the here and now, but I was also living through the several years of ongoing treatments and struggles that I had gone through happening simultaneously. So as a parent, I would really encourage you to create space for your child to be able to talk about experiences, but also not to be too pushy. And remember that support and just being present again is truly one of the most powerful ways that you can help.
And I also think that maybe you could speak to parents of particularly of kids who have been through some kind of traumatic experience, disaster, cancer. Speak to the parents about their the reality of their own identity issues that are wrapped up in that. The fact that it's not just the child that went through this and is now a survivor, but there may be some trauma work for the parent to be doing about their own the different life that they have than the life they thought they were going to have, and the different expectations they now have for their child than they might have had. Can you just speak to that as well?
You know, in the disaster emergency management world, there's a common phrase that you'll hear a lot of relief workers use, which is that they'll say that all disasters are local, meaning that all disasters happen and impact a community. So when a disaster hits, it's not just striking one person. It's striking everybody that's a part of that person's lives, who's in their neighborhoods or their overall community. And when a personal disaster hits, we oftentimes give a lot of attention to the person who's actually got the diagnosis. And we sometimes forget to support the people, the caregivers, like parents. And when the child is going through something, the parents are definitely also going through this right there with them. Mm-hmm. And it's really important for them to realize that it can be hard for them to sometimes give that child additional freedom that in some ways they want to protect them so much that it's hard for them to break out of the mold of what that experience was when they were going through that, again, that difference between surviving versus survivorship.
I love that. Okay, so now is this language, I'm just curious, is this language and information that if somebody engages in kind of a study of disaster ministry, they will also be equipped at a different level for this kind of personal engagement?
Oh, most definitely. And that was the thing that really caught me off the guard, was that when I was going through my cancer experience, I had this one day in particular where I remember it was winter, and because of my chemotherapy, if I took a deep breath, the coldness would actually feel like I was gargling ice, like it was just the pain. And if I had the wind hitting my skin and just feeling like small razor blades, it was incredibly painful. And in that moment, I remember just crying out in prayer to God. And as I was praying, I kind of had this moment where I became aware that I was praying to God and aware of the thoughts that I had, and suddenly became aware of how I had studied this exact same sort of thing in disaster populations and knew that prayer would help. But I didn't really understand how sometimes giving up control gave people more control. But in that moment, I came to understand that in my own personal life. And so started to see these things that I had done in the disaster world now playing out in my own life. And then also that translating to helping others. I was giving a talk shortly after I finished my treatment to a group of disaster responders and humanitarian aid workers. And I was sharing with them about how to provide care to each other when they're going through struggles, and suddenly realized that those skills that I had learned from doing disaster work definitely made its way over into helping people in their times of personal crisis as well.
All right, friends, you are hearing Dr. Jamie Ayton. He is an associate professor of psychology at Wheaton College. He's also the founder and co-director of the Humanitarian Disaster Institute, HDI, at Wheaton College. The book is Disaster Ministry Handbook. It's designed to help churches prepare for disaster and provide relief to survivors and care for the vulnerable and help communities recover. But what we're saying here today is it's applicable in not only your own life, but in your life of ministry with others who encounter what we'll call personal disasters, like a devastating diagnosis and then the ongoing hurricane for a year of treatment. So you can follow Jamie on Twitter at Dr. Jamie Ayton. That's A-T-E-N. He's a 10. There you go. And you can follow the Humanitarian Disaster Institute at Wheaton HDI. Jamie, thank you so much for being with us again on The Reconnect.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, Carmen.
All right, friends, I'm going to post a link to the YouTube video where Jamie talks about a lot of these things. But if you just search YouTube for his name, Jamie Ayton, A-T-E-N, that YouTube video will populate for you as well. But I will, I'll be sure and tweet it out for those of you who are on Twitter. Follow me at Carmen LaBerge. All right, friends, it's time to dive below the fold. This is the point in the show where we like to lift up stories and make connections that are designed to help you either start or engage in conversations that do not initially appear to be about God, but where the introduction of eternal principles might just change not only the conversation, but the course of another person's thinking and their living. So what we're trying to do here is, you know, you are a fisher of men. That's our calling in Jesus Christ. We are fishers of men. And so this is, you know, sort of how you set the hook, right? So how do you set a hook in a conversation that draws a person in and draws God into the conversation along with that person? Because, you know, ultimately the goal is to get that person hooked up with God. So there you go. So I'm going to lift up today something that is happening for the 101st time in the United States of America, and it is called the Indianapolis 500. So it takes place, not surprisingly, in Indianapolis. And so there are all kinds of interesting things about the Indianapolis 500. And so you can think about the wacky traditions. You can think about the fact that apparently for every Monday in the month of May, people for whom this event is significant, they apparently have checkered flag Fridays. And they wear all sorts of cute and creative outfits leading up to the race. There's also, at the end of the Indianapolis 500, this tradition of chugging milk. You've seen this. It's kind of gross. Like they pour, I mean, it's they're chugging this milk, and the milk is pouring out all over them in some cases. And you're wondering to yourself, how did that start? Well, it actually started when Lewis Meyer won the race in 1933. He chose milk to refresh him on a hot day because his mother recommended it. In fact, she recommended buttermilk. Anyway, again, this is a different time. But somebody in the milk industry a couple of years later said, you know what? That's great. Let's make that happen every year. This is a good marketing strategy. And the milk industry put up prize money for the race in 1956. And therefore, milk is now the traditional celebratory beverage at the end of the Indy 500. So it's going to take place this weekend, and lots of people will be talking about it. And you're saying to yourself, how do I get God back into that conversation? Well, here was a little fact that I discovered that frankly fascinated me. In the first Indianapolis 500 race, so 101 years ago, the speed that was required to win the race was an average of 75 miles per hour. So when you think about, could you drive 75 miles, could you drive 500 miles at 75 miles per hour? And you say to yourself, yeah, I think I could probably do that. Maybe not without a pit stop, but, and that's why we call it that. But that wouldn't win the race today. That wouldn't even get you anywhere close to the race. Today, actually last year's race, the winner had to average 166 miles per hour for 500 miles. So could I drive 500 miles at an average of 75 miles per hour? Yes, and it would take me a fairly long time to do that. Could I drive 500 miles going 166 miles per hour? I kind of doubt that I could do that. Now, it would be a much shorter period of time. I'm covering the same amount of ground, but I think this is a good analogy for the way the pace of life has accelerated, not just in the last 100 years, but, you know, in the last 100 days. I don't know about you, I feel like we are running at a breathless pace. 75 miles per hour for 500 miles, we can do that. We can make those four consecutive turns over and over and over again, and we can safely finish the race with all of our parts and pieces intact. 166 miles per hour, taking those same four turns at the same distance from each other for 500 miles over an extended period of time, no, most of us cannot do that. And so this breathless pace that we have been running now for some period of time as a culture, in my view, increasingly results in the kinds of disasters that we see, these high-speed disasters where, you know, cars just clip each other, right? And so in these high-speed lanes of life, chances are you're going to clip some people because none of us can maintain the level of intense focus that is required at such a high speed over such a, frankly, monotonous route around these, you know, incessant going around this loop over and over and over and over again. So here's my invitation to you. When you talk about your summer plans, get off the grid. Jesus led his disciples to a remote place where they could be by themselves. Now, granted, the crowds actually got there before them, so you got to prepare for that. But Jesus made it a practice to get up early in the morning and go to a solitary place to pray. If Jesus needed it, how much more so do we? Get yourself off to a solitary place. Get yourself some alone time with God. Be still and know that God is God. Focus on Psalm 46:10. And on this holiday weekend, make the holiday weekend holy. Set it apart unto God and set yourself as holy unto Him. All right, friends, this is The Reconnect. Have a great weekend. I'll see you back here on Monday. Great day and God bless.
The Reconnect is brought to you by the Presbyterian Lay Committee. To continue the conversation and become part of the Reconnect community, visit reconnectwithcarmen.com.